Our guest today is Dr. Peter Burkholder, Distinguished Professor of Musicology at Indiana University's Jacobs School of Music. Dr. Burkholder is a respected authority on American composer Charles Ives, having written and edited several tomes on Ives. His writing appears in the New Grove Dictionary of Music and Musicians and several academic journals. Dr. Burkholder is the most recent co-author of A History of Western Music and the Norton Anthology of Western Music, adding to the work of Donald J. Grout and Claude V. Poliska. Dr. Burkholder, A History of Western Music, the Norton Anthology, and the New Grove Dictionary are fundamental tools of academic musical study in the Western tradition. How did it feel to be approached as an author in this series?
Oh, I was quite honored. First of all, the New Grove came earliest, and I was asked to write the article on Ives, and I suggested maybe you'd like an article on musical borrowing. And the editor indeed responded positively about that, so I did that too. And I was very gratified that that got singled out in a couple of reviews, including the New Yorker review. The way I get into working on A History of Western Music is that I certainly referred to it when I was an undergraduate. I taught out of it for many years, used it as a textbook. And about 10 years ago or so, an editor from W.W. Norton came by and said, "How do you like using it?" And I said, "Well, my students find it hard to read, so I give them questions, study questions, to use to dig out the ore, you know, to mine the jewels from the text." And that led to him commissioning me to do a study guide. And then after I'd done a couple of those and Claude Poliska was ready to give up continuing work on it, they passed it on to me. So I felt, wow, I've suddenly come in possession of a tool to communicate to thousands of students a year and other people as well who like to read the book.
And Grout and Poliska were two titans in the field. For most music students, the history of Western music is referred to by their last names. How does it feel to hear it now? I don't know if you hear it in the halls being called the Burkholder now. Do you have the Burkholder yet? How much does the Burkholder cost this year?
It's fun. It's a little freaky, but it's fun.
And you mentioned having written on musical borrowing, that's using existing material as a basis for new compositions. How do you see this as similar, taking what was given to you by Poliska and Grout and then, you know, doing your own musical borrowing, I guess?
That's a really interesting question. I was encouraged by the publishers to think about it anew. It had first come out in 1960. And Claude Poliska had been asked pretty much to respect the structure that Donald Grout had set up and had added to it, of course, but the publishers felt that it needed a major overhaul. So the first thing I did was to submit something like a 50-page outline of how I thought the book should be structured, breaking it up into chapters differently and putting people in different places, focusing discussions in different ways, and adding a lot of material as well. And the publishers liked it, sent it out for review, got responses from a couple dozen people who were either scholars or teachers in the field. So ultimately, I felt like I was writing a new book and plagiarizing mercilessly from the original one.
And writing an all-encompassing work of Western classical music probably makes you need to be pretty well-rounded yourself in the overall structure and the history of it. How do you, if you can at all, reflect areas of your own personal interest in there? Was there room for you to expand on existing areas of something that you felt needed more?
Yes, indeed. Actually, the implied first question is, so how did it feel to have to know everything? And my response to that was, when I was working on it, I felt like I was face-to-face with my own ignorance every day. I like to tell my students that the more you learn, the more you realize how ignorant you are. And the depths of my ignorance were never so baldly shown to me as trying to write a book about everything. But they did give me a lot of freedom to incorporate things that I thought were necessary. And having, as I said, having a couple of dozen reviewers looking at the book and looking at my work made me feel confident that if I went overboard in some direction, they would haul me back into the boat. So among the things I felt was necessary was to integrate music in the Americas throughout the whole story. there had been relatively little in Grout's original version. Claude Poliska had added a chapter at the end that was about music in the United States and had basically gone back to the beginning again, now having done all the way through the most recent music in Europe. He went back to the beginning to write about music in the United States. So it was at least there, which is important because it's covered in a lot of music history teachers' courses, but it was set off on the side. And I felt actually that as soon as Europeans come to the Americas, European music is in the Americas. And indeed, some of the most interesting aspects of European music turn out to derive from the Americas. A very interesting idea of building variations over a repeating bass line called the chaconne. The chaconne or the chacona turns out to come from Central America. One of the most famous Baroque dances is the saraband. Bach wrote more sarabands than he wrote any other kind of dance. And the saraband or the zarabanda comes from Mexico. So that's interesting. And there's a lot of other things that come over the water. So I felt it was important to integrate American or music in the Americas into the whole history. I also thought that it was important to at least acknowledge what was going on in popular music and in the non-classical traditions, partly because a lot of the early music, music up to 1800, was actually functional music or popular music. And so that was already included. To exclude it then in the 19th and 20th century seemed odd to me. One of the reviewers objected to my putting in some jazz pieces into the anthology, saying, this is mere tokenism. And my response was, well, yes, that's true. When you're doing an anthology of 180 pieces of music that cover 1,500 years of history, everything you do is tokenism. But that's the idea. Everything gets put on the map. Everything is arranged on the family tree. It's not intended to be an intensive study of everything. It's intended to be an all-you-can-eat smorgasbord. And if you're intrigued by any of it, then go off and study more about that.
What do you see, having had to remind yourself of maybe things you'd forgotten, or just putting everything together into one book, do you see any unifying aspects that come through the history of music?
Yes, indeed. I decided that I wanted to organize it around four themes. Let me read from the preface. Mm-hmm. First, to focus on people. So focus on the people who created, performed, heard, and paid for this music. Very often, music history focuses just on composition, but I wanted to also get patrons and the public in there. The choices they made and why they made them. So people making choices was an important theme. What they valued most in the music. So very often, the only way you can explain why a particular type of music becomes prominent or why a particular composer or piece is favored by a number of people is to talk about why they value it. What is special about this? And I think that's particularly important when the music is strange. That's true of some medieval music. That's certainly true of some 20th century music. Why would you do this? It seems to me that you have to foreground that. And then the fourth theme is how these choices reflect both tradition and innovation. That seems a constant theme. The tradition is formed by emulating in some way what your predecessors have done, and yet it would be a dead tradition if you weren't constantly doing something new. So those four themes seemed to jump out at me from the material I was working with, and I just tried to foreground them.
Are there trends that you see come back? Is there a cyclical nature in music that people are trying to maybe run away from one concept, but then the generation after them, they come right back to that same thing?
Several people have pointed out interesting cycles in music history. One of the most interesting is that every 300 years in around 1300, 1600, and 1900, people wave the flag of new music. So Ars Nova, the early 14th century, the idea of a new art, or in the early 17th century, around 1600, Le Nuove Musiche by Giulio Caccini, the idea of this new music. And they were very conscious in Italy that they were inventing a new musical style and new types of music. And then in the early 20th century as well, with music that became atonal, there was just a sense of newness. Anton Webern gave a series of lectures that he called The Path to the New Music. And there was this sense of novelty there. Why it should happen every 300 years, I have no clue. I don't think there's any particular reason for it. It may just be that we notice it because of the coincidence of every 300 years. There also have been back and forths between complexity and simplicity. In the late 14th century, coming out of the Ars Nova in the 14th century, what that essentially was a new system of notation that allowed music to become more precisely fixed and therefore more complex in the composition. And the rhythm got very complex towards the end of the century in something that was later called the ars subtilior, or the more subtle art. But the early 15th century reverts back to simplicity in what looks almost like a reaction to that. You get a similar sort of thing happening in the 18th century with the Baroque style, very fussed up and heavily ornamented, where rage as an emotion, for instance, is depicted by roulades of notes. And then in the 1720s, 1730s, other composers, especially of comic opera, begin to depict it in completely different ways, with patter songs, very fast, rapid speech, quite different from these sort of old Baroque style. And the 18th century style that develops into the music of Haydn and Mozart is much more simple than the type of music that Bach and Handel were writing. Something similar has happened recently in minimalism, which at least some people see as a reaction to the complexity of avant-garde music and 12-tone music and other things that happened in the mid-20th century. So that does seem to be a pattern.
The text addresses the large genre of classical Western music. Is there any way in the book, or is it cross-pollination addressed at all, especially with a lot of the composers coming from Asian countries in the 20th century, coming to classical music but bringing some of their tradition with them?
Yes, indeed. The last piece in the anthology actually is by Bright Sheng, and the title is Seven Tunes Heard in China. And I just have one of those seven tunes included. It's a piece for solo cello that sounds at times like one of the Bach solo cello suites, and at other times like he's playing a bowed string instrument from China. The tune itself sounds very Chinese, but the way it's elaborated is sometimes sounds Baroque or Western, like motivic development or spinning out ideas of 18th century Europe, and sometimes it sounds very, very Chinese. So that kind of interplay. He's a composer who was born in China and now is in the United States. But that interplay also can be seen in other ways earlier. For instance, in John Cage's interest in Asian ideas, in the form of his pieces, which is not at all the same as Indian ragas, but based on a similar idea of organizing by duration instead of by beats. And his use of the I Ching from the Chinese fortune-telling idea, that from the mid-20th century. And then earlier, there is, of course, interest among composers in things from across the water. There's a piece by Rameau, for instance, called Les Indes Galantes, the genteel Indians, including, by Indians, he means people from all over the world who aren't European. And so there's a South American group, there's an Asian group, etc. Interesting.
How long does it take to do a revision of a rather rather large and extensive book like this?
Well, since they had asked me to do a wholesale revision, I anticipated that it would probably take 3,000 hours, which is a year and a half's full-time work, and it took about 6,000 hours. So I underestimated, which is about 3 years full-time work. So over the course of 3.5 or 4 years, So it was a lot.
And I hear that you are currently in the process of doing the next edition. Is that correct?
Yes, but that's not a wholesale revision. That's touching it up.
Is there anything new? I imagine that by the time you get done with 3 years of full-time work, there's a bunch of stuff that's happened in those 3 years, and you have to choose, do I go with what has already I've spent the last 3 years doing, or is something so important that I have to do that? How are those decisions made, and is there anything really new that's going to be into the next edition?
Yeah. The decisions are made partly, again, through seeking outside guidance. So we did a little survey of 250 users of the book about pieces in the anthology. Which pieces do you use? Which pieces don't you use? What editions might you like? And drew from that a list of some pieces to add. We didn't drop very many. It gave us a good sense of what people were looking for. So the publishers said, yes, you can have another CD or two. So that helps for the anthology, just space. In terms of new things, let me just give you one example, which is that a book came out almost simultaneously with my book called Medieval Music and the Art of Memory by Anna Maria Busenberger, who's a musicologist out in California at University of California at Davis. She's been working for some time on this question of memory, and this book kind of distilled all her work, put it all together. She argues that what we see as the written traces of the medieval tradition, especially before the 14th century, are not written music like, say, a 19th century composer would do, which is the way they were first encountered. In other words, music that someone works out on paper in notation. But she suggests that a great deal of this music, including some incredibly complex music, was worked out by memory. And she offers what the mechanisms probably were in comparison with other kinds of memorization, memorization of texts, memorization of scientific principles. The teaching strategies that were used at that point very often relied on memorization. So for instance, for the repertoire of the Cathedral of Notre Dame at Paris, which was just being built in the 12th and 13th century when a great repertoire of music was also being constructed there, she says that was not written down and then sung from notation, but was probably improvised and written down at a very late stage. That is, not improvised so much as composed orally so that it could be repeated, but using particular figures that are actually in a treatise that she can point to. It's wonderful to watch this process happening. So she's not arguing that notation is not important, but she is arguing that once we can write things down, we don't necessarily stop improvising or doing things by memory. The comparison, although she doesn't make it in great detail, the comparison to jazz obviously jumps right to the fore. There's written material in jazz. You write down these head sheets that you're playing from. So you have some idea there. But once you've memorized that, you can improvise and you know the chord changes. Or you can be playing from a completely notated arrangement. And it could sound pretty similar. That's the kind of thing that is interesting. And that required me to rewrite many passages in several chapters, which took a certain amount of last summer.
You mentioned earlier that you authored the study and listening guide for History of Western Music and the Norton Anthology of Western Music. What would be your advice to an incoming music student who's picking up the book for the first time?
Don't try to read it all the night before the exam. I think the best advice is to approach it like pearls on a string. There is a string, that is to say, there's a kind of continuous narrative going through the whole thing. And that narrative can be found in outlines, in the study guide, to some extent in things that are said at the very beginning and end of each chapter or each section. So there is a thread there. But a lot of the focus is on individual pearls, that is to say, a section on Bach, a section on, even within the section on Bach, a section on Bach's instrumental works, a section on Bach's vocal works. The chapters are designed so that you can actually read them in one sitting in, say, an hour and a half or less. But that might be a lot to take in. And it might be better to sit down, read a chunk, listen to the music, or maybe start with the music and then read a chunk, go back to the music, and do it in small pieces. Like I say, it's designed to be a smorgasbord. It's a kind of all-you-can-eat buffet. And you can eat more if you take small portions.
What about the instructor who is teaching it for the first time? Many of them will have learned from previous editions. How does that instructor, or should that instructor, approach your edition?
I think because I've conceived it fresh and in many cases put things in a different order, that offers the opportunity to teachers to rethink the order that they present things in, which can annoy you when, certainly when I'm teaching and a new textbook comes out, I want to know, where is everything? But I think it also is an opportunity to refresh, to rethink, to focus on something else. One of the things that many people have told me about using the book is that it does certain things very well, and that way they can just let the students engage with the book and to some extent with the study guide, certainly with the music in the anthology. And then they can focus on something else. Or there can be a kind of debate back and forth, or an interchange, a conversation. And I think that's a useful way to think of it, that what's going on in the textbook is not the only thing that's going on in the course. What's going on in class is not the only thing that's going on in the course. Ultimately, what's going on in the student's head is the important thing. And so that's one reason why I enjoyed starting this whole project with the study guide, thinking about how can I digest this book down to really bare bones chapter outlines without dropping any really essential content. How can I then write questions that takes people back to the book itself to get all the stuff that I dropped? Then how can I write questions about the pieces that gets them to see things that aren't even in the text, but to explore things for themselves?
If you aren't a university student, why should you pick up this book, or how should you approach it if you do pick it up?
Well, what's interesting about this particular book is that lots of people do buy it from general bookstores and read it on their own outside of class. In fact, I discovered as I was halfway through my revision that one of my friends said, I love this book. He'd read the first edition. This book opened classical music to me. Don't break it. I was like, oops. But what I tried to do was not just write it for students, but write it for people who are not in class, who are just interested in music, and aren't necessarily even going to read it all the way through. I always write for my dad, and my dad is interested in classical music, doesn't read notation, doesn't perform in any way, never has, but he's very interested in it. And what he and my mom do is when something comes on the radio, they listen to classical radio where they are in Urbana, Illinois. And when something comes on the radio, they look it up in the index and go dipping into this book and find out what is there about Handel's oratorios here, or what is there about this Spanish composer. And so I tried to make sure that it was a book that you could dip into, read a couple of pages, enjoy, set aside. And if I can do that, if it's enjoyable to read every page, then I've really accomplished something.
And that makes me think, I know that you were credited by Alex Ross in his book last year, having helped with the final tweaking of his Listening to the 20th Century. And I would imagine that having something like this sitting on your coffee table, if you were reading a book like Alex Ross's, then you would be able to have something to go then deeper into what you're reading.
That's right. That's right. Alex Ross's book is a really fun read because it takes a different approach to much of the same material. There are incidents that he goes into in much greater depth than I can. And in other respects, he assumes some background or doesn't sketch in some areas that I then sketch in. So it's interesting, actually, to read the two in tandem.
We've been talking to Dr. Peter Burkholder, the author of the 7th edition of A History of Western Music and distinguished professor at the Jacobs School of Music. Dr. Burkholder, thank you.
You're welcome.